Welcome, and thank you all for joining us this evening. This evening's event is actually sponsored by the Daiwa Anglo-Japanese Foundation and hosted by the OSC's Law Department. My name is Louise Arimatsu. Can you all hear me? Yeah? And I'm with the LSE's Center for Women, Peace and Security. Now, it's my privilege and pleasure to welcome a distinguished panel of speakers who are all experts on this very important and topical issue, closing the gender gap. Now, before I turn to the topic of this event, there are a few housekeeping matters. First of all, we are not expecting the fire alarm to go off, so if it does go off, then please treat it seriously and make your way outside or through those doors through the front entrance and outside across the road. There's a meeting spot, designated meeting spot, and Simone, who is here third on our along the road, row here in black, will probably lead us all to the meeting point. Okay, I do not expect that to happen. Second, please, for those of you who have got mobiles, which I presume everyone has, please put them on silent mode now. Thank you. Now, before I introduce our panel of speakers, I'd like to hand over the floor to the Director General of the Daiwa Foundation, Mr. Jason James, who is here to tell us a little bit about the foundation and the work that it does, including, of course, to generously support events such as this that's taking place this evening. Now, Jason has long taken a personal and professional interest in promoting strong relations between the UK and Japan. He read Japanese studies at King's College, Cambridge, and subsequently worked for many years in the financial industry, specialising in Japanese equities, both here in London and Tokyo. And from 2007 to 11, he was the director of the British Council in Tokyo and a board member of the Japan-British Society, among other posts. So, Jason, can I ask you to...
Okay. So I'll just stand up so you can hear me. I'm not going to take up very much of your time because this is not really about me or the Daiwa Foundation. Just two things to say, really. The first is we're delighted to be able to do this together with LSE. And the background is that we brought Professor Kosaki over from Japan, and so we're working her extremely hard this week. She's doing three completely different events. One was yesterday, one today, and one competing with the football tomorrow evening. All on three totally different subjects, but they are all connected to gender issues, in which she's one of Japan's leading specialists. And then the second thing I'd like to say is just, if you aren't aware of the Daiwa Anglo-Japanese Foundation and you're interested in Japan, you need to know who we are. So we're the largest charity working in the UK-Japan space, which admittedly is quite niche. We have an office by Baker Street Tube Station where we have a very active programme of events, which is run by my colleague Nama here. We also have an art gallery, which mainly specialises in contemporary Japanese art, although at the moment, unusually, our current exhibition, none of the artists is actually Japanese. And as well as that, we have grants programs and we have scholarship programs, either of which may be of some interest to you. So if you are ever going to do a project involving collaboration with academics in Japan, or you want to run a cultural project, bringing a Japanese group over here, do have a look at our grants programs. On the scholarship side, we have two main programs. One is specifically for graduates in Japanese studies. We fund them in postgraduate programs. And the other is for graduates in any discipline. We send them to Japan for 18 months, all expenses paid, teaching Japanese and trying to get them Japanese books in their future careers. So if you're interested in either of those things, do have a look at our website. But I won't keep you any longer. I'll pass you back to Louise.
Thank you.
To chair the session.
Thank you. Okay, so as many of you are aware, the reference in the title to 2030 is to the Sustainable Development Goals, which were adopted by states in 2015 that essentially built on what were the Millennium Development Goals. Now, of the 17 SDGs adopted, our focus tonight is on SDG 5, namely to achieve gender equality and empower all women and girls. Now, the targets that have been identified to achieve this goal include, for example, to end all forms of discrimination against women and girls everywhere, eliminate violence against women and girls in all its forms, ensure women and girls' effective participation in political, economic, social life, universal access to sexual and reproductive health, equal rights to resources, land rights, access to technologies, and the list goes on. This is an enormous agenda with pretty ambitious targets. So are we on course to meet them? Well, from the latest findings of the World Economic Forum, as some of you know, the answer must be no. Let me take a moment to remind you and quote from the report issued. In fact, it was the annual report, the Global Gender Gap Report, which was issued by the World Economic Forum late last year, which states, quote, "This report finds that globally, gender parity is shifting into reverse this year for the first time since the World Economic Forum started measuring it," and that was in 2006. The report continues, "On current trends, the overall global gender gap can be closed in exactly 100 years across the 106 countries covered since the inception of the report, compared to 83 years last year. The most challenging gender gaps remain in the economic and health spheres. Given the continued widening of the economic gender gap, it will now not be closed for another 217 years. These are clearly very disturbing findings. So how can we account for this reversal? Can these trends be reversed? What are states doing? What needs to be done? Now, these are just some of the questions I'm sure our speakers this evening will address. Our experts will each speak for around 20 minutes before we open up for Q&As with yourselves. My first speaker is Rosie Cave, who is currently the head of the Gender Equality Unit and the head of the Office of the Prime Minister's Special Representative on Preventing Sexual Violence in Conflict at the FCO. She leads the FCO's work on promoting girls' education, the Women, Peace and Security agenda, on the UK's Preventing Sexual Violence in Conflict initiative, and LGBT rights. Wow, the list goes on. You will have seen from the leaflet that Rosie has huge experience and expertise, particularly in the context of the protection of women and girls in conflict and post-conflict environments where challenges are magnified many times over. So, Rosie, I hand over to you.
Thank you very much. Do shout if you can't hear me. It's a real pleasure to be here this evening. Thank you so much for inviting me, and thank you for the sponsorship. I have to say that now I've heard about the Daywell Foundation, I'm very interested and wishing I was younger. But and funnily enough, we had a meeting with the Japanese Ministry of Foreign Affairs today talking about the G20 and gender equality and women's empowerment, because they'll have the presidency next year. So wanting to make sure that key things like gender equality, girls' education are up high on the list of things to tackle. So as I was introduced very kindly, I do work at the Foreign Office. I actually have a background working for NGOs and the UN, and have been in the civil service for about 5 years, previously at the Stabilisation Unit working on conflict and stability. So I do cover a lot of issues. I won't list them all again, but I do have the great opportunity to work closely with the Foreign Secretary on his girls' education campaign, which I will tell you about in a minute because I'm obliged to do that, and also with Lord Ahmed in his role as the Prime Minister's Special Representative on Preventing Sexual Violence in Conflict. We at the Foreign Office, we have a Foreign Secretary who's very passionate about these issues. He has committed to us having a foreign policy that consciously and consistently delivers for women and girls, which I think is great. It can still prove to be a bit of a challenge to integrate those gender perspectives across the board, which I'm sure you can all appreciate, but it's great to have that commitment at the highest level. That was very much underscored through the appointment of our first special envoy for gender equality, Joanna Roper, who actually has done a number of postings in Japan and is very passionate about Japan. So she'll be disappointed she's not here, but she's in Bangladesh today with one of our ministers. So obviously a lot of the work that I do is actually international facing, outward facing, and not so much about domestic policy and what we do on the gender pay gap. That's actually led by our Government Equalities Office, but they very kindly helped me understand that issue better. And actually it's a really important issue for us to be championing internationally with our partners, and I will return to that. So we work very closely with domestic departments like the Department for Education and the Government Equalities Office, as well as the Department for International Development and the Ministry of Defence on a whole range of these issues. I was just thinking, I haven't been clicking my slides. Should I go and... How should I do this?
Well, I can.
Really?
The mic here works as well. If you want to stand.
I can stand.
Yeah.
But then I'll be standing in front of it, which may not help. Try my best.
Right.
Skip. Thank you.
Okay. Is that okay for everyone? Yes? Brilliant. Great. Okay, so this is what I'm going to talk about. I've kind of covered the first one already. I am going to talk about girls' education and why that's important. Then the gender pay gap, and just touch on our Preventing Sexual Violence and Conflict Initiative and also Women, Peace and Security at the end. So I did talk about that. This is good. I'm on track. That's a positive thing. So, girls' education campaign. I hope everyone is aware that Boris Johnson is fully committed to girls' education, and he launched a campaign with DFID and DfE in April at the Commonwealth Summit this year. The overall aim of it is to achieve 12 years of quality education for all girls by 2030. So going back to your point around the SDGs and all the SDGs related to that and the ambition of 2030. Importantly, this isn't just about getting bums on seats. We know that access to education is a challenge for a lot of girls, but we want to go beyond that. We want to ensure that there is quality teaching for girls as well as boys, that there's institutional reform that makes sure that the education system really is delivering for them, and that we reach the most marginalised. In terms of the campaign, we are looking at things like girls' education and emergency, so places like Syria, looking at the Rohingya crisis, making sure that refugees can access primary and hopefully secondary education. Also, those marginalised girls who might be affected by issues such as FGM, child early forced marriage, the threat of sexual violence or the reality of sexual violence on the way to school, in school, etc. And thirdly, also wanting to promote girls' education in STEM issues and also in leadership. So we've got a number of aims with it. We definitely want to be leading by example, and that's true for all of our gender equality work. And that's very much about us working with other governments and international partners to invest in good teaching and do the work on system reform that I mentioned. We want to build international political commitment. This has been a lot of the work we have been doing in the Foreign Office, both with the Commonwealth Communique, where we got all 53 member states to sign up to 12 years of quality education by 2030. At the moment, we're in the throes of a UN Human Rights Council statement, which the Foreign Secretary went to Geneva just over a week ago and spoke about the campaign, and we read out our statement on, I think it was last Monday, I'm getting very confused with days and weeks at the moment, but we have actually now got almost 140 UN member states to sign up to that. That is a record for any statement on any issue in the Human Rights Council, so we're pretty pleased about that, and we want to aim even higher. So looking forward, we're also looking at the UN General Assembly, we're looking at the G20, which I mentioned, the G7 summit, we just had the leaders commit to this as well. We want to boost global investment. I'm sure you will have seen there are lots of announcements about how much money is put into girls' education, and we're very lucky that DFID see this as a priority and are able to invest significantly in this sector. But we want to make sure that others are doing it. And we also want to make sure that that money is spent efficiently and effectively as well. It's not simply about giving money out. We want to make sure that it really works. We want to harness UK expertise. There's lots of experts that we have within the UK. We want to look at how we can share that knowledge and expertise with others, but also learn from others as well. And thinking about not just people in government, but obviously civil society, the private sector, academics as well. And importantly, we want to engage with the UK public. We definitely want to raise awareness of the importance of this issue. We have lots of challenges with our own education system here and girls in education. Some of the things that I talked about, like violence in schools, that's an issue for us here as well. So making sure that we're raising awareness both of the importance of it, but also the work that we're doing both domestically and internationally. So we do know that gender inequality in education partly drives gender inequality in economic participation. And I just wanted to touch on this because we know that in developing countries, a deprioritisation of girls' education, often driven by patriarchal cultural norms, heavily restricts access to employment. And in advanced countries, gender equality in rates of education is better, but there are disparities that exist in subjects. So, for example, STEM, which I talked about earlier, we see women less likely to study STEM subjects than men, and in fact, in that sector, wages can be higher. So, although we think girls' education is really, really important and is necessary, it's not going to be the only thing that gets us to gender equality. So we need to be doing more than that. So I just wanted to set the scene a little bit with where we're at in terms of gender equality in economic participation before I move on to the gender pay gap, and not wanting to get confused between gender pay gaps and gender equality. Okay. So despite significant progress globally on gender equality, women still have lower labour market participation rates and do the vast majority of the world's unpaid work. Global female labour force participation rates stand at 50%. Compared to 76% for men. And improving gender equality and participation could add $4.2 trillion to the annual global GDP growth by 2025. And I think we'd all agree that would be great if we could actually achieve that. Gender inequality is strongly associated with income inequality, and IMF research shows that this is true for advanced economies as well as developing economies. In advanced economies, income inequality arises mainly through gender gaps in participation, and in developing economies, it's driven more by inequality of opportunity in terms of access to education, political empowerment, and health, and other issues. So closing the gender gap in economic participation would raise living standards in developing countries, and more policies allowing women to work and also have children at the same time in advanced economies would ease the pressure on ageing populations, which I know is an issue in Japan, because our special envoy talks about that quite a lot, and womenomics, I hear about. Just wanted to give you a stat that closing the global gender gap in participation could significantly increase UK and global growth rates, so by 0.27% per person, I think, and 0.4 respectively, as well as addressing existing problems around income inequality, demographic pressures and productivity. So I think we would all agree that this is an important thing to make progress on. So I just wanted to check that we're all talking about the same thing when we're talking about the gender pay gap, which is as much for me as it is for anyone else. There are lots of issues that I've worked on, like stabilisation, and realising that if we're all using the same word but using different definitions, there might be a problem in terms of the substance. So just double checking, but I'm guessing you all know this, that the gender pay gap is the difference in the average earnings between women and men, which is not the same thing as unequal pay, which is when men and women get paid differently for doing the same job. So Why are we interested in closing the gender pay gap here in the UK? This is a really important issue for our Prime Minister. She has made it clear that tackling injustices like the gender pay gap is part of building a country that works for everyone. Women working in the UK still earn less than men on average. Too few women get to the top, and too many are concentrated in lower paying sectors and occupations. Greater transparency is key to addressing this because it exposes the barriers women face in the workplace and motivates employers to take action, which will help to accelerate change. That's why the UK has introduced groundbreaking regulations requiring large employers across all sectors to publish annually the differences between what they pay male and female staff in average salaries and bonuses. So this groundbreaking legislation was developed in consultation with business, engaging widely with employers, HR professionals, trade unions, and other key stakeholders. No other country asks for such a level of detail to be published, and several countries are now looking at our model to help inform and shape their approach to this issue. So in April 2017, the government introduced regulations requiring all employers with 250 or more employees to report specific gender pay gap metrics on an annual basis. This information must be published on their own websites and on a government portal. And that's by the 30th of March for every year for public sector organisations and the 4th of April for private sector and voluntary organisations. I've listed here the metrics that are required. So there's the overall gender pay gap, the gender bonus gap, the proportion of male and proportion of female employees that receive a bonus, and the proportion of men and women working at different pay quartiles. So in the first year of doing this, we have had over 10,000 employers report their data, which I think is pretty exciting. I think those of you who were looking at the media around that time will also be aware that pretty much all of them reported that there is a gender pay gap. And I think it was quite interesting in terms of flagging up some of the really patriarchal attitudes and behaviours that there are in terms of the workplace and what needs to change and why women aren't getting the same pay as men. So just to be clear, the Government Equalities Office owns this policy, but it's not responsible for undertaking enforcement action in respect of gender pay gap reporting. That lies with the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which holds statutory powers to conduct enforcement action against organisations that have failed to comply with their duties under the Gender Equality Act 2010. So, what else are we doing to close the gender pay gap? So the full-time gender pay gap has actually fallen to a record low of 9.1%, but the overall gender pay gap is 18.4%, which is up from 18.2% last year. Progress has been made in sectors with the largest gaps, including finance and insurance, and those with a high proportion of women employees, such as retail. I do have some stats from different government departments, but not from my own, which is remiss of me, but I realised I couldn't look it up because there's no internet connection down here. So with DFID, the mean gender pay gap is 3.6%. The Home Office, the mean gender pay gap is 10.1%. And the Department for Education, it's 5.3%. That's for the year 2017 to 2018. I recollect that the FCO one is around the 10% mark. I think, importantly, we know that reporting isn't sufficient. That isn't going to close the gender pay gap, and there's lots more that we need to be doing. So this is very much part of a wider piece of work that the government is doing to support women in the workplace. So this includes a £5 million increase... this includes £5 million to increase returnships. There was quite a lot about this in the media recently. Offering 30 hours of free childcare and introducing shared parental leave and new rights to request flexible working. So a little bit more detail on that. We've got shared parental leave enables working parents to share up to 50 weeks of leave and up to 37 weeks of paid leave in the first year of their child's life. And an estimated 285,000 couples are eligible for this each year. And I think statistically there's lots of evidence that proves that actually if parents did share that parental leave a lot more, that would help women get back into the workplace and help tackle this issue quite significantly. The right to request flexible working now gives all employees with 26 weeks continuous service the legal right to request flexible working. Anyone here do flexible working? Well, we've got quite a lot of people in my team that do flexible working, and it's quite a common practice actually across the FCO, as I'm sure it is across other government departments. With Returners, we've introduced this £5 million fund that supports women and men who've been out of the labour market for a long period. And on childcare, all 3- and 4-year-olds in England can benefit from 15 hours a week of early education, which can save families around £2,500 a year. In September last year, we doubled this to 30 hours for working households of 3- and 4-year-olds. We've also introduced tax-free childcare worth up to £2,000 per child per year and £4,000 for disabled children, with which around 2 million families could benefit from. There's also quite a lot going on in terms of making sure that we can get more women into senior positions so that they can be making the decisions that affect other women. So a large part of that focuses very much on women in the business sector. And we support Hampton Alexander Review's business-led targets for 33% senior leadership positions and board positions to be held by women by 2020 across the whole of the FTSE 350. The number of women on the FTSE 100 board has increased from 12.5% in 2011 to 27.7% in 2017. There are no all-male boards remaining in the FTSE 100, which is down from 21 that existed in 2010. And we're very proud of this progress, but we do recognise that there's a lot more that we still need to be doing. And I think, importantly, we need to be engaging with senior men as much as we need to be championing the role of senior women and getting more women into senior positions. And I see this across the work that we do on gender equality. Men as champions on all of these issues are absolutely critical to change attitudes and behaviours, and that leadership and pushing down is really, really important. So, again, publishing data is a valuable first step to closing the gender pay gap, but we do know that more needs to be done. Reporting is an annual requirement, so we will be able to see progress, we hope, on a year-on-year basis. But we do know that we can't do this alone. We need businesses to step up and take action, and that's why we work closely with employers and trade bodies to help them identify barriers to women's career progression and put plans in place to overcome them. Going forward, we'll be supporting employers by working with industry and academics to create evidence-based, practical actions they can take and make sure employers are fully aware of the steps they should take to make a real difference. Although the government and employers have important roles to play, the causes of the gender pay gap go much wider, and we need the support of the UK public to bring about fundamental change in society that's needed to close that. I think, importantly, just bringing it back to my international focus, it is really important that we look at sharing what we're doing on closing the gender pay gap, as well as what we're doing more generally on gender equality and women's empowerment, both sharing sort of lessons learned, what has worked, but also what hasn't worked, what is best practice with international partners. But we also want to be learning from them. I think when I think about girls in STEM education, we're very clear that there's a lot that we still want to be learning from others. You know, we haven't got the perfect answer yet, and there's a lot more that we can be doing. But I think, importantly, there's a whole swathe of things that need to happen to create a better enabling environment so we can actually achieve gender equality and women's empowerment. So just briefly, on other things that I focus on, we have our National Action Plan on Women, Peace and Security. Anyone familiar with that agenda? So normally I talk to lots of people who are like, yay, 1325. So this is all about a UN Security Council resolution, 1325, and its associated resolutions on women, peace and security. And this is both about recognising the detrimental and disproportionate impact of conflict on women, but also, really critically, the important role that they play in building peace and stability. We have published our fourth National Action Plan in January this year. It's owned by the FCO, DFID, and the MOD. We have 7 outcomes. One of those outcomes is around women in decision making, and that's really important. That's both around political participation, but also more generally in economic and social spheres. It's about women's involvement in peace processes, women in mediation, etc. There's also a lot of work on security and justice, peacekeeping, making sure that gender perspectives are integrated into those areas, and also that the role of women at all ranks is promoted too. So I won't go into lots of detail, but it is worth looking at, and there is a connection between these things. And then the Preventing Sexual Violence in Conflicts initiative, which I hope some people have heard of. This was launched by our former Foreign Secretary Lord Haig, and the UNHCR Special Envoy Angelina Jolie back in 2012. This is very much about tackling the stigma that survivors of sexual violence face, so one of the key barriers of sort of girls' education, access to the workplace, also securing justice and accountability for survivors, and preventing sexual violence from occurring in the first place, working with militaries, media, faith leaders, etc. I'm only flagging this because we're going to have an international meeting in November 2019 to really shine a spotlight back on this particular issue. But importantly, we need to look at the enabling environment to make a change on conflict-related sexual violence. So I do think a lot of these issues will come back up again, and it's an opportunity to shine a spotlight on them as well. So I will stop there and welcome any questions when we get to that bit. Thank you.
Speaker is Eleanor Gentile, who is a policy analyst and projects coordinator in the Gender Equality Delivery Unit with the OECD. Eleanor is responsible for the development and implementation of OECD programs, tools and products which aim to strengthen gender equality in public life across member and partner countries. Eleanor brings a quite different perspective into this debate that now looks to how and in what ways international organisations like the OECD can assist and guide states in meeting their commitments. So I hand over to you, Eleanor.
Okay, thank you very much to everyone. Thank you to LSE and Diamond for inviting the OECD to this very interesting occasion. My role today, I guess, is to build upon what our excellent speakers already talked about and try to give some insights on the effectiveness of gender-affirming institutions. In 2017, the OECD released a big gender report, which is looking at how OECD member countries, there are 37 countries, among which Japan, are implementing the two OECD gender recommendations. One of them has a specific focus on economy, and this gender recommendation on gender equality in education, employment, and entrepreneurship. And then there is another specific recommendation that looks at how governments are organizing themselves to actually deliver on gender equality goals. And it's called the gender equality recommendation in public life. So the 2017 report had a very eloquent title. The title is The Pursuit of Gender Equality, an Uphill Battle. So I think the titles say a lot, and I'm not going to add much to what was already said. So progress has been really slow, and in some areas even kind of regressed. But that is a little bit also controversial, because on the other hand, when we look at what governments have put in place, we see that there is much more political commitment, also at the leadership level. There is much more gender equality strategies that have been approved. There is more skills across government institutions to work on gender equality. So why all of this is not giving the results that we expect? So this is what I will try to explain. And this is what, and my conversation builds on a very extensive data collection that the OECD conducted last year across all state institutions. So we didn't look only in the executive, so looking at how ministries implement different policies, but also at how legislature works for gender equality and how the judiciary works for gender equality. So we involved all these institutions in our member countries, trying to tell us what they are doing, how they are organizing themselves, what kind of capacity they have in place. And we had some interesting insights of what is working and what is not working. These are our two recommendations. I just mentioned them. But it's important also to see that the OECD has somehow a mandate to look into their member countries, because these recommendations are not imposed. This is our member countries who adopted them. And the recommendation, they set specific standards and also some very practical indications on how they should achieve the standards. So they're really like very concrete tools and commitments. And the OECD has a mandate to monitor progress and implementation against these tools. So this slide comes from our uphill battle report. So let's say the not so bright picture. I'm talking about our OECD member countries. So it's a little bit more of a specific point of view rather than the big picture that Rosie provided. But it's just to give you a sense. I mean, some of these things we already talked about them. But so in education, yes, 48% of women, of girls who are enrolled in university studies are actually achieving and graduating, and 36 of men. But then when it comes to STEM, so scientific fields, the percentage dropped to 20% of women making it there. And then also when it comes to employment, the employment gap is 11% across OECD countries, but when it comes to women who are also mothers, it becomes more than double, it becomes 23%. And of course, less than one-third of all managers are women on average in OECD countries in the private sector. The average gender pay gap across OECD countries is 15%, and the interesting data is that this percentage basically didn't change in the last 10 years. It remained the same. When we look into public life, we have still a lot to do. When it comes to an average in legislatures and senior management, we talk about a figure that is about 32%. But then when it comes to women in politics, it's about 29%. And then also it's very interesting to look into that in self-employment, entrepreneurship, 17, it's like the percentage of women who are able to become self-employers is basically half of the percentage of men, and also that women earn less from self-employment than men. So these are just some data that we got from our uphill battle. Of course, there is much more details on this, and I encourage you to visit the OECD website to look into the report. But it's just to say that we are not really progressing on closing the gender gaps. So on this year, for the 8th of March, for International Women's Day, the OECD launched 1 month of activities, our March on Gender, and the title of it was Closing the Implementation Gap. So now we're not talking only about gender gap, we're talking about the implementation gap, because it's really about implementation. How can we implement initiatives that are actually making a difference? And the implementation gap is a governance and mainstreaming gap, and this is why, I will explain this concept more, but this is why the OECD this year also launched a toolkit for gender mainstreaming and implementation, which is a very practical, concrete guide for governments, but also for any institution working in the private sector, on how they can actually make their gender initiatives more effective and achieve better results. But before I go into the details of what is the implementation gap and where we are at, I would like to give you a picture of where we are trying to go. So this is kind of the model. So what a gender-sensitive state should look like. And this is based, of course, on the recommendations of the OECD and what our member countries' ambitions are and where they would like to go. And I have to say, unfortunately, that no member country has this in place 100%, but of course these elements are all in place in different places. So it's not coming out of theories, coming out of actually the practices, actual practices, and putting them together to see what a good model could be. So obviously we need leadership from the highest level. It's leading by example is important. Giving the commitment and the responsibility from the top is very important. And then we need to have guidance and direction. So having an overarching gender equality and inclusiveness strategy in place is very important, because otherwise any state institution would not know what priorities to work on and which direction to take. All government institutions, all state institutions have to be involved, but also they have to liaise with civil society, they have to liaise with the private sector, and they have to also look into the multi-governance layers, because not sometimes, you know, you have great policies at the national level, and then when it comes to local level, you don't, or vice versa. You can have incredible practices and policies at the subnational level that are not reflected in the national. So that is a very important link, the link with civil society, that also is about, you know, having open governments, really governments who are engaging in a constant dialogue with civil society and really checking whether their priorities are the priorities of people, of their constituency, and then all branches of power, the executive, the legislative, the judiciary, they have to put in place mechanisms and capacity that allow them to look and to see the gender dimensions of all what they are doing. And this is a lot about what I will tell you now. So how can we make all decisions? And when I say decision, I include also decisions about new laws or reformed laws, policies, budgets, programs, services, anything that a state institution do, it's a decision. So how these decisions can really reflect the needs and aspirations of both men and women. So it's not only about women, it's about both. So how can we include that perspective in everything that is done? So what tools do we need? What mechanisms? What capacity? How we can be sure that there is some accountability also in place, that also institutions realize whether they are doing bad or not, or less good, because sometimes they don't know, they just simply don't know. So there needs also accountability. Is very important to show that sometimes things can be improved. And then, of course, diversity in the workforce and in leadership is very important, because diversity brings different perspectives. I mean, the UK is doing a fantastic job with the Equalities Office, really on looking into diversity in a very broad manner, which is not the case for all member countries. And also how institutional frameworks, so how institutions themselves, when it comes to human resource policies, when it comes to, you know, work environment, how they can change that to become more welcoming, more more enabling to have both men and women on board, and also to do things that are relevant for both men and women. So this slide is a very important slide, because it gives you really a big picture of what are our preliminary findings from all the data that we collected last year, and what are we talking about when we talk about implementation gap. Here you see a little bit the areas that were investigated. So we have strategies and institutional frameworks, tools and evidence, accountability, and inclusive institutions. Here you have key progress, and here you have key gaps. Let me just help you to navigate through this. So, for example, on strategies, the majority of OECD countries have now in place a specific gender equality strategy. And also they have in place gender equality, specialized gender equality institutions, which is very important, because they are the ones having the expertise, they are the ones keeping the agenda high, the gender equality agenda, they are the ones stimulating everyone else. So in that sense, we are doing a lot of progress. But then when it comes to the gaps and how this function, we see that unfortunately, for the implementation of gender equality strategy, often there is lack of resources, and I'm talking about financial and capacity and human resource capacity. There is also some uncertainty when it comes to mandate of the institutions, how much power they have to to make a change and to influence the others. And also another point is that these gender equality strategies in some countries are not really linked to other national priorities. They're kind of a standalone parallel track. So the people working there are doing a great job, but then people working on budgeting or finance or on agriculture, they are doing something else. So that is not helping in making change. When it comes to tools and evidence, we have an increased adoption of a gender mainstreaming model. What is a gender mainstreaming? I mean, most of you probably know, but I will just repeat to make sure. So gender mainstreaming is just about finding ways to include a gender perspective, a gender awareness, obviously through data, through evidence, in every process, every decision-making process, as I said before. So the interesting data from our data is that not only the ministries, but also, for example, judicial institutions, and the UK is one of the countries doing excellent job in the judiciary, and legislature, a little bit less, are adopting a model where they assess gender gaps, they found mechanism, then they establish a specialized body within that branch. For example, the judiciary has a specialized committee or commission that works on gender equality. This commission adopts a specialized plan or policy to address gender equality gaps, and then some of them allocate specific budget and resources to that. So, of course, the effectiveness of this model, it's really different across countries. But the interesting part is that in the last, 5 to 8 years, OECD countries have really moved across state branches to really comply to this model. So to try to put in place some kind of capacity and mechanism that actually regularly allow them to include gender considerations in their work. Also, gender budgeting is increasing. Gender budgeting is the inclusion of a gender perspective in the budgeting process. Very important, because without money, there is no change. And half of OECD countries now have some kind of gender budgeting process in place. And also, there is increasing number of member countries that are making it as a requirement to include a gender analysis of primary legislation. So it has to undertake a gender analysis. So now, what is the downside of it is that this gender perspective is not applied to different government processes. For example, procurement. Among the 13 countries who responded to our survey, only 2 said that they include a gender perspective in their procurement policies. And procurement is a very important part of government actions, because it actually mobilizes a lot of funding and also a lot of partners. So it can have a big impact. And as well, planning, monitoring the evaluation, if you go a little bit farther than just policies, then gender perspective becomes very little. And also there is a problem with the data. So with really having a regular and relevant collection of data that are useful for doing gender sensitive policies. On the level of accountability, we have a variety, I will show you a slide about that later on, a variety of oversight institutions that are in place, but with very different mandate and mechanisms. Also, most of the OECD countries have in place a gender equality parliamentary committee that countries say is very effective in providing oversight, although we don't really have data of how effective it is and why. And then also the downside is that, for example, in Parliament, when parliamentary committees in generally receive a violence against women bill or something that has to do specifically for women empowerment, but when it comes to economic policies or other important policies of the country, they don't go to the gender equality committee. So how to make sure that all policies and laws are actually looking into gender issues. And then, of course, there is a limited coordination with budget committees, and we go back to the gender budgeting part. So you can have the best laws, but if they're not properly resourced, nothing is happening. And finally, inclusive institutions. The good data is that work-life balance measures like working from home or part-time options are increasing, very much increasing. But, for example, there is a very limited use of gender targets. So, so if you don't, if an institution doesn't set a direction or what they want to, you know, what they want to achieve from now to 5 years or to 10 years, then it's these measures could be applied in general, but not really utilized. And also, what is interesting is that these measures often do not apply to senior positions, so not making really a difference. And then also, of course, and conscious and unconscious gender bias in human resource management policies is very much there. So how to deal with that? That is a big question that many, many governments are starting to think and starting to look into innovative tools like behavioral insight studies. So the how can we tackle really inner beliefs of people who are working and carrying the responsibility of institutions for them not to perpetrate gender violence, gender bias. Okay, now I will just show you a few graphs. So this is about the gender equality strategy. So I said that most of the countries have it in place, but when we look about the focus, the thematic focus is really different. Some of them may be only focused on economic empowerment. Some of them are only focused on violence against women. You know, so it's how much is overarching, that is the question. So they have it in place, but the goals can be very narrow or can be very broad. This is about the nature of gender equality institutions. I told you before that there is an issue with how much power they have. So 46% of member countries have an independent ministry with representation in cabinet. But also, you know, it doesn't mean necessarily that this is the best option, because sometimes these ministries are very small and with very little resources. Also, 36% has a gender equality unit in Ministry of Social Affairs or equivalent, which is a bit of a more traditional way of looking at gender equality, more related to social affairs policy, family policies, children's policies. Then 9% have gender equality units inside the center of government. It could be the prime minister office, it could be the head of government, and then some others have a different kind of nature. So this is just to leave a question: what is the best way, most effective way? This is something that OECD still didn't answer. We are talking with our countries to decide what is the best model, because we have different strengths and weaknesses, but we still don't know really what makes more sense. This is an example from the judiciary, but just to go back to the issue of appropriate resourcing and budgeting. Here it shows how the judiciary across some of the OECD countries replied are allocating earmark budget for gender equality actions. So only three have United Kingdom permanent allocations. Now they really have put in place a very good system. But then some others have temporary allocations, so maybe ad hoc, if they feel that for a certain moment there is a gender priority, so yes, we put money, but then later on, no money. And then other countries have no money allocated. Tools and evidence. Here you have, when I talked about the different tools, so just it's not really very clear, but here we have a dark blue and the light blue row. The dark blue is when countries declare that they always, for example, implement gender budgeting. So it's, in this case, it's until here. And then this is countries who implement it sometimes. So as you see, the dark blue is not very long in general. Yes, they adopt most of this, but most of an ad hoc base rather than on a regular base. This is about the collection of gender disaggregated data, which are the base of gender statistics. Obviously, gender statistics are not just about gender disaggregated data. They are also about data that makes sense for gender equality. But if you don't have disaggregated data, then you cannot make sense at all. So, and it's an idea of how much data, gender disaggregated data, are collected across policy areas. And then the interesting part, of course, is that you have very high data collection in education, in health, in social protection, which are the policy area which are traditionally considered important for women. But when it comes to defense or environmental protection, you don't get the gender disaggregated data. So how do you know how policies in this area actually impact women and men differently or how relevant they are. Another interesting data is this, which I find a bit surprising, that general public services that are in general the ones who do collect disaggregated data, you know, health services, education services, seem to have not really a very good capacity or commitment to collect regularly. So that is a bit worrying because this is the base for knowing what the needs are. Here you have also about data collection, what are the challenges, different perspective. Here is the perspective of central gender equality institutions. Here's the perspective of line ministries. For example, the issue of capacity comes in both, but in a different way. So central equality institutions are somehow complaining that there is no capacity in line ministries to collect data, so they don't get them. They cannot offer an overview, and which is also here. But then the top challenge for line ministries is that there is no formal requirement for them to collect gender disaggregated data, so they don't feel obliged to do it. They don't have a push to do it, so this comes even before the capacity. So if you are not required to do it, then you don't establish the capacity and you don't do it. Accountability, here I have a sense of what are the different institutions that provide accountability for gender equality. As I said, the most common one is the parliamentary committee, but also you have the ombudsman, you have other institutions also in the judicial side. And here are the countries that have, which are the majority, have a parliamentary committee specialized in gender equality. And finally, about inclusive institutions. So then, as I said, the average number of women in senior management as well as in in the judiciary, in the Supreme Court, is 32%. When it comes to national legislatures, it goes to 28%. These are some of the work-life balance, the measures that are adopted in parliaments in particular. And then here you have an interesting data, but not really exhaustive, which says that there is a number of countries who are collecting data on sexual harassment in the workplace. Still, there is no analysis of this data. Okay, well, how did the OECD support member countries to actually respond to the implementation? That is about setting standards, the recommendations. It's about generating comparative evidence to the data that we collect and analyze. It's about giving tailored support to countries who want to do it, of course, on how they can increase the implementation. For example, last year we did a gender review of Canada, which was really interesting. And then we have, this is the main tool of the OECD, is stimulating peer-to-peer dialogue. So it's really countries talking with each other about what works and what doesn't work. Thank you.
But the thing is, you know, the decision making, the